Good morning. 6 minutes after 9 o'clock, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What most of us actually know about Ireland and Irish history could probably be covered by a hat with room left over for a bottle of Jameson's. And yet each year millions of Americans celebrate St. Patrick's Day drinking green beer, wearing Kiss Me I'm Irish buttons, even if we aren't Irish, decking ourselves out in Kelly Green outfits, trying on bad Irish brogues, and listening to Celtic music. Since it is part of the WPR mission to seek the truth and share it with everybody, we thought it would be a good idea to actually talk with someone who really is Irish, really lives in Ireland, and who could teach us something about the real Ireland. Joining me by phone this morning is Donal Casey, an Irish illustrator and cartoonist whose political cartoons have appeared regularly in McGill magazine and trade union magazines such as Work and Life and publications of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. Casey is also a lecturer at Dublin Business School. Donal Casey, welcome, and thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm looking forward to hearing some of those bad brogues.
Really? Well, don't tempt me, because I might just bust out with one. What's the view from your side of the Atlantic of all of the St. Patrick's Day celebrating that goes on in America?
Okay, well, first of all, I think people are very conscious of the fact that the St. Patrick's Day celebrations, the parades and the public festivities pretty much began in America. St. Patrick's Day as a holy day would have been a day of observation for many centuries, but the idea of having large parades, I think we definitely copied from America. So not only that, but rather controversially, but it happens every year, the Irish Prime Minister, the Irish Taoiseach, visits Washington every St. Patrick's Day, and many other government ministers travel around the world. The idea being, I suppose, to promote international connections. But so we're very conscious of how big a thing it is over there. I suppose a lot of American high school bands have always come to Ireland, even before the parades became such a big deal in Dublin. I mean, they've become a much bigger deal in Dublin since the 1990s. The St. Patrick's Day has now become the St. Patrick's Festival. And it's you know, children love it. School kids love it. It's also definitely marketed as a tourist attraction, as a way of attracting visitors to the country. So,
and as a tourist attraction, how does it work?
Basically, the exact figures I've seen, they don't topple off my tongue as easily as somebody who follows this all the time, the numbers. But basically, I mean, right now, I mean, I live very close to the center of Dublin. Right now, you'll see hundreds of Americans, Italians, French, Spanish tourists milling around. And presumably, they're here to watch the parade. So there's a large, on Saturday morning, well, it'll be Saturday midday, between 12 and 2 o'clock, there's a large parade through the center of Dublin. But all during the St. Patrick's Festival, as it's now called, the days surrounding St. Patrick's Day, there's live music in pubs and bars. There's a ceilidh on Merrion Square. A ceilidh is like a, you know, traditional dancing, and so on and so forth. And as far as I know, I mean, they've very much been attracted by marketing, advertising campaigns, you know, definitely targeted to come here for this event.
Well, tourism, a significant piece of the Irish economy?
Hugely. Again, I don't know the exact figures, but definitely beyond, you know, the proportion of, let's say, countries of a similar size like Denmark or Finland. And, you know, I would sometimes feel, and the impression of a lot of people, we almost depend too much on it. I mean, we should be doing more to create, to make things or to do things. But yes, you know, it's a very, very important part of the Irish economy. And as some of your listeners probably know, I mean, we've been suffering probably the worst recession in our history as an independent state, particularly since 2008. I mean, the international credit crisis, the international financial crisis, we were, I think, the second country in the European Union to enter into recession, and we haven't really left. So tourism does tend to be seen as a huge help to the economy. And in the last year, tourism does seem to have increased as well.
Yeah, let's talk about the Irish economy for a moment, because as you mentioned, in 2008, the bomb kind of dropped there, and why was it so much? Why did it hit Ireland so hard?
Well, there are a number of reasons, and again, everybody would have a different perspective on this. But the government at the time, quite simply, agreed to guarantee bank deposits. Now, that to a lot of people sounded like a very good idea at the time, and as is the case in the United States, none of this had ever really exactly happened before. I mean, all of these strange derivatives and securitizations and so on and so forth, nobody even knew what they were. These are words we've all had to learn in the last few years. The Irish government at the time, we got a new government last year, they were eventually voted out, agreed to guarantee the banks. Now, the banks were in a much worse state than even the most pessimistic commentators had suspected, to a very large degree because of the property bubble. Ireland, again, very briefly, Ireland had an economic boom. Some of your listeners may have heard of the Celtic Tiger, was the nickname given to the economic boom between 1995 and pretty much right up to 2008. But in the later years of the economic boom, it was hugely disproportionately dependent on the property sector. I mean, a really, really high number of people were either directly or indirectly involved in construction in this country, and there was an enormous amount of speculation. Banks were lending money to developers, speculators. Everything was going fine once the bubble kept on getting bigger, but when the bubble burst very, very quickly, among other things, the banks were left, they were very, very vulnerable, particularly, well, one of the best-known banks, it's now gone, it's been renamed, was a bank called Anglo-Irish Bank. So the government basically agreed to guarantee the banks. It left the banks were in a much worse state, so it's left the entire national economy in a state. I don't know if we're bankrupt or not. I mean, it's hard to define these things, but the International Monetary Fund and the European Union, the European Central Bank, basically had to bail us out as a nation. So we're currently very much beholden to international bodies. And a lot of people wish they really understood exactly what was going on. It's a very confusing situation economically. So I hope that explains briefly the current situation. Unemployment has been shooting up. It was down to about 2 to 3% during the economic boom. Now it's hitting 15%. Emigration has started again. I mean, for the first time in generations, emigration stopped pretty much. But now young Irish people have begun leaving again, going to Canada, and Australia. So,
okay. So the property bubble burst, and the banks were left holding a lot of worthless paper. But what I've noticed just as in preparation for this, trying to read some Irish press and so forth, they're going to great lengths to separate the situation in Ireland from that of, say, Greece or Portugal or even Italy.
That's a very interesting observation, and I suppose there has been a tendency, and I don't know how much of this is government spin, how much of this is reality, but there's been a tendency to portray ourselves as the best boys and girls in the class in terms of we're doing everything we're asked to do. We're making all of these. There's been a horrendous amount of cutbacks and social spending and so on, but it's all happening. It's all happened, and there's been very little public protest. That's a point I'll come back to actually later on when we start talking, if we talk about St. Patrick's Day and the parade, the two things actually link in a curious way. So, yeah, the idea has been, and it is probably true, that the Irish government has sort of done more what they were asked to do by the international bodies to which we're now beholden because of the bailout funding we have received. We are told that we're doing better than particularly Greece, which has come in the last few weeks so close to actually even leaving the Eurozone. It hasn't happened.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the Eurozone and Ireland's relationship with the EU.
Yeah.
How is that seen now? You've been a part of it for a while. What's the mood in Ireland?
Okay, and the mood, like so many things to do with politics, depends on who you speak to, but one thing I can say objectively is there's been a great increase in anti-European Union feeling, which there's been a tendency to blame, and particularly France and Germany, the two largest parts of the Eurozone, largest members of the Eurozone. This could probably be traced back over the past few years. Whenever there's a very significant change in Ireland's relationship to the European Union, there has to be a referendum here. And the last two referenda for the so-called Lisbon Treaty back 4 years ago now, and then a couple of years before that, the Nice Treaty, the first vote, people actually voted against the European Union Treaty. And there were things to do with enlargement and so on of the European Union. We were given a second chance, in a sense, to vote correctly, and we voted correctly. We voted in favor. There's going to be another referendum here in a couple of months about the so-called fiscal compact treaty, which is about the Eurozone, which is about the Central European Union institutions having more direct control over such things as budgets and such things as making sure people don't misbehave, which has been, I suppose, the case with some of countries like Ireland, Greece, Italy, Spain in recent years. So it's very much up in the air as regards how we're going to vote. A lot of people will automatically vote no because it's to do with the European Union and talk about bringing back the old Irish currency, the punt. An awful lot of other people will be frightened of, okay, this is a bad situation, but it would be much worse if we were to leave the European, if we were to leave the Eurozone. It would be even worse than it already is. So it's there's quite a bit of confusion as well, and the emotional reaction, I suppose you could generalize and say that it's ambiguous as regards the European Union at the moment.
The talk about the political parties in yeah. Ireland and the political landscape and who has the power?
Yeah, so that's something which changed dramatically last year. We have our current government is a coalition government which has a very large mandate in terms of the vote they received in 2011. A political party called Fine Gael, which is an Irish language name, and the Labour Party, who are essentially a centre-left social democratic party, but again, Ireland being, I don't know, I suppose one of the most conservative countries in Europe, even our left is not that left wing. So there's a coalition government who've been there for not even a year. I mean, they've been there since 2011 and pretty much working with a very difficult situation. Before that, a very until then large political party, also an Irish language name, Fianna Fáil, it's often translated loosely as Soldiers of Destiny. They had been in power for three terms of office since 1997 in coalition, generally, with smaller political parties. They changed their coalition parties during their time in office. And, you know, most people tended to see that particular party as being responsible for such things as the bank guarantee, which led to the state becoming, you know, needing an international bailout. The two large parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, one of the peculiarities of the Irish political landscape is that for a very long time, the two largest parties are very similar in their social and economic policies, both pretty much centre-right. And that goes all the way back to the Civil War, which happened here immediately after independence in 1922. There was a civil war, and there was a party who were in favour of the treaty with Britain. There was a group who were against the treaty. They had a war about it. And the two main political parties were derived out of those two sides in the Civil War. So as often happens, particularly in small countries, I mean, politics runs in families, and people tended to just vote or support a particular party based on their family or their local tradition. That's all changing now. So Fine Gael and Labour are now the main parties in Ireland in a coalition government.
What's the Irish attitude toward America these days?
Okay, and again, a lot of it would depend on who you talk to, particularly whether the person is on the left or on the right. But one thing I will say, and I'm going to quote, I teach a lot of American students. One of my jobs, as well as working as a cartoonist, is I do teach Irish studies courses to students from the United States. And we were on a field trip in Northern Ireland just there during the weekend, and a couple of students were saying, why do Irish people like us so much? They were almost bothered by it. They were almost suspicious of it. So there is a strong, on a human level, I think, Irish people, insofar as you can generalize about anything, but Irish people and Americans seem to get on very well. There's sort of a tendency to talk a lot and a tendency to chat, a tendency to be friendly. Now, so on that level, yeah, on a human level, people have so many family connections and so many personal connections with the United States, much more than I would imagine most countries in Europe. On the other hand, of course, particularly during the George Bush period and so on, there was very, maybe a certain amount of anti-American feeling was beginning to emerge, but nothing compared to, I lived in Spain for many years, nothing compared to the sort of thing which was an almost knee-jerk reaction to anything America did was bad. There, certainly in Ireland, we're just too closely connected, I think, for that to be a situation. I can continue, I hope I'm not talking too much. Barack Obama was here last year, and he'd received a rapturous reception. And I remember, of course, he has a vague family background, a place called Moneygall in County Offaly. I think it was his great-great-great-grandfather on his mother's side had come from County Offaly in the Irish Midlands. But yeah, there was a rapturous reception for Barack Obama when he came here. When Bill Clinton came here, particularly during the peace process in Northern Ireland, again, I think it was Frank McCourt, the Limerick novelist, the author of Angela's Ashes, who said, rather humorously described Bill Clinton coming to Ireland as, and the rapturous reception, as a needy man has met a needy people. So that could be an interesting angle on the Irish-American relationship, I don't know.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Well, we need to take a quick break, and when
sure.
we come back, I want to invite our listeners to join the discussion. Questions about Irish politics, the Irish economy, Irish culture. We have a real Irish person here to perhaps answer them. 800-642-1234. That's a number that works just about anywhere, although I don't think it works in Ireland. 800-642-1234. You can send an email from anywhere in the world, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can look for The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment there, and we'll share it with the listeners. My guest this morning is Donald Casey. He's a political cartoonist and educator in Ireland, and we're talking about Ireland. And why? Well, Saturday is St. Patrick's Day. So when you call in, if you want to try on your bad Irish brogue, feel free, and maybe we'll ask our guests to judge them, and we'll see which one's the best.
I'll put on my bad American accent.
There you go. Well, good luck with that. Okay, well, we'll be right back in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:24. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on today on the Ideas Network, after 3 on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, Jean Faraca and her guests discuss Islam and democracy. The Arab Spring surprised many in the West who believed Islam is inherently incompatible with democracy, but the citizens of Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya proved them wrong. That's after 3 o'clock today on Here on Earth with Jean Faraca. This hour, we're talking about Ireland and Irish politics, the Irish economy, Irish culture. My guest is Donald Casey, an Irish illustrator and cartoonist whose political cartoons have appeared regularly in a number of publications. He's also a lecturer at the Dublin Business School. We have callers who want to join us, and let's start with Phil in Madison. Phil, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Top of the morning to you.
That'd oh, there you awesome. Go. Okay. dear God.
I'm actually the cartoonist here in Madison, so I think it's great to talk to an Irish cartoonist.
Oh, you're Phil. I've actually, the Madison State Journal.
Yeah.
The Wisconsin, I've actually seen, I look on Kegel or whatever that is it Kegel, C-A-G-L-E? They have a selection of political cartoons from the United States, and your work appears every now and again.
Oh, yeah.
I was looking at Wisconsin Public Radio, and I started looking at other things, and I saw, so you had nice drawings.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I was curious why there are so few daily newspapers in Ireland. I was there, about a year ago, actually about exactly a year ago, and was surprised that, like, Galway does not have a daily newspaper, and,
yeah.
and a lot of the smaller, you know, a lot of the, we wouldn't consider them small towns.
Yeah,
I know that Ireland's a much smaller country, but you know the La Crosse, which is the same size as Galway, has a daily newspaper. And why there are so few newspapers in Ireland? And I can
that's very interesting. And I was in Indiana last summer with friends in Michigan City, which is again I don't know the population, but they had a daily newspaper, and I remember commenting in the exact opposite direction, saying, "How do you manage to have a daily newspaper in such a town the size of where I come from, where at best there's a weekly newspaper?" I think, from what I understand in the United States, there's such a strong tradition of local press and perhaps even less of a tradition of national press. There are a lot of weekly newspapers in local areas, and they're very widely read and taken very seriously. So the most obvious answer would be the population. There aren't enough people to sustain a daily newspaper on a local level. I mean, the main national newspapers are having, like in the United States, the print media is having a terrible time surviving, and they're doing all sorts of, you know, dumbing down in all sorts of directions. Even the very distinguished Irish Times, in certain ways, are bringing in more lifestyle articles and so on to try and maintain readers. I think that just the population isn't there. Now, another thing, just you asked about why there are so few daily newspapers in Ireland. One of the peculiar things about Ireland is if you go into a newsagent's where you buy your newspapers and magazines, you'll see an awful lot of British newspapers as well. So we have the Irish broadsheets. We have Irish tabloids, which are usually Irish versions of British, notorious British tabloids like The Sun. So you'll have a newspaper called The Irish Sun or The Daily Mirror. You'll have a newspaper called The Irish Daily Mirror. But you'll also see British newspapers like The Daily Telegraph. You'll see The Times. You'll see The Guardian. A lot of Irish people would read The Guardian, for example, particularly on a Saturday, because it's a sort of centre-left newspaper, and we don't really have one of them here. So it's quite a complicated, quite a saturated media landscape, but complicated by the fact that we have so much exposure to media from and so much access to media from our enormous, by our standards, our enormous neighbour across the water in Great Britain.
Phil, thanks. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Greg in Madison. Greg, good morning.
Thanks, John. And the media angle is interesting because I believe it was on this show when the Rupert Murdoch scandal was breaking that the guest mentioned that England, being a very small country, could have a national daily paper in a way that a larger country like the U.S. could not. But my question was really regarding the Irish view of Scottish independence.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know they're going to have a referendum, and it's going to be on the anniversary of that famous battle where a very small number in the 14th century, in 1314, I believe, where a very small, was it Bannockburn, where a very small number of Scottish troops defeated a very large number of English troops. I will be perfectly honest and say it's not something people have paid very much attention to, and I do spend time with people who are interested in politics, and it's not something, it's in the newspapers. Insofar as it impinges on Ireland, well, the most pertinent question would be if Scotland were to become independent, which I believe is unlikely. It's unlikely that a large enough majority would vote for independence, the status of Northern Ireland. This is where it would become more of a... I know internationally Ireland and Scotland sort of look fairly similar, and people often say the accents sound very similar, but to us, Scotland is actually very much another country. So it would impinge on us mostly if Scotland were at some point, probably not next year, but at some point, to become independent, it would make the situation in Northern Ireland more complicated. It would complicate things there. But so, if you were to ask the average person, are you in favour of Scottish independence, they'd probably say yeah. But I don't know if people would have spent an awful lot of time really thinking about it very deeply.
How would Scottish independence affect Northern Ireland? I didn't quite get that.
Yeah, okay. It wouldn't have any legal effect on it, but it might call into question, well, I mean, if Great Britain begins breaking up, it would almost by extension weaken the links between the other constituent parts. So the United Kingdom, Scotland, Wales, England, and Northern Ireland. So it would just make their situation perhaps feel a little bit more precarious. Mm-hmm. There would be no direct effect immediately, but it would certainly call into question, well, why does Northern Ireland have to be part of Great Britain if Scotland have left? Okay. It would maybe perhaps give them less moral justification for that.
All right. We're talking about Ireland, the real Ireland, not the Ireland of motion pictures and pop culture in America and the sort of caricature view of Ireland. But we have a guest with us from Ireland, Donald Casey, an Irish illustrator and cartoonist. He's also a lecturer at the Dublin Business School. And let's go to John in Milwaukee next. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Hello, John.
All right, Donald, my grandparents, my father's side are from Ireland. I have a very Irish name. The question of the day is this. Knowing that Northern Ireland will always side with England in a controversy, why don't you refer to it not as Northern Ireland, but as Occupied Ireland?
It's very much the vocabulary we use to refer to Northern Ireland is the sort of the neutral term, so there are about seven different ways you can refer to it, and I suppose the neutral term is Northern Ireland. Then you can go in one direction and say, I don't know, the six counties, the occupied six counties, even the term the North of Ireland has a nationalist tinge, whereas referring to Northern Ireland as Ulster can have more of a unionist tinge. So I suppose it just depends on the context of your conversation. It's very much to refer to it in those terms would be to express an opinion, I suppose, a very strong opinion. John, occupied would be a term I would have difficulty with, in the sense that there are, you know, the key situation in Northern Ireland is that there's a large number of people living there who've been living there for several centuries who want to be part of Britain, another very large number of people. So it's essentially, it's as much an internal difficulty, I feel, as one to do with Britain and Ireland.
John, thanks for that call. There's a line available for you right now if you want to call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email and Facebook also work, talk at WPR.org. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook. One caller who couldn't stay with us wanted to know what the economy of Ireland was based on nowadays. It used to be based on electronics and technology. Has that changed?
No, in that sense. And I mean, so it's interesting to hear the term. I thought when I heard the beginning of that question, it used to be based on agriculture, which it was up until the 1960s, 1970s. Now, there are parts of the economy, such as electronics, high-tech, pharmaceuticals, which are still performing well, and particularly in exports. So, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There are parts of the economy which are still, I was talking IT, especially. I was talking to a friend of mine who works in IT, and he said they can't find people to fill positions in certain IT companies. So it's not that the entire country has completely gone to ruin. Certain parts of the economy, certain parts of the country are still functioning. So to answer your caller's question, yes, I mean, they would still be a very significant part of the Irish economy. I mean, the other very important thing to be aware of with the Irish economy is the massive amount of international investment, foreign investment, and multinationals, of course, particularly from the United States. A number of things attracted them to Ireland, but the exceptionally low corporation tax, which is 12.5%, was a huge factor in attracting all sorts of, I mean, Facebook have their European HQ here, Google have their European HQ here, Twitter have their European HQ here. There were other reasons for choosing Dublin to do that, but a very low corporation tax was a huge part of that. And that corporation tax, when you were asking about Europe, the European Union earlier on, they're not happy with our low corporation tax. And one of the fears with the Compact Fiscal Treaty referendum in the next few weeks is that it could lead the way to us being forced to increase our corporation tax and therefore lose a lot of international investment. So.
Okay. Let's see. Let's go to Brighton next and hear from Nancy. Nancy, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I wear my one-quarter Irish heritage very proudly. I had lunch with a friend of mine who's from Ireland, and most of her family is there, and her husband's family is there as well. And she had told me something that was very sad. She had said that her family has attended many funerals for suicide in Ireland, and that she mentioned that Ireland had a very high rate of suicide. And I was wondering if your guests could comment on that fact, if it is in fact true, and does it have any correlation, as we jest about the green beer and the pubs and such and how charming they are, is this related or could be related to alcoholism? And I'll take my your comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, the answer, first of all, is yes, there is a problem with suicide here now, and it certainly has increased with the recession. As regards, and it's something, there are lots of campaigns in the media and lots of debate about there not being enough funding for campaigns in the media. A disproportionate number of the suicide victims are young men. I think that seems to be the case in many parts of the world, by which I mean between 18 and 35. The connection with alcohol, again, I mean, and the bonhomie and the cheerfulness and everything else, but I suppose the flip side of that cliche, which is not entirely mythical in Ireland, is this sort of deep tendency to sort of melancholy and depression, I suppose, you know, as much as that sounds like a bit of a caricature. So, yeah, there are those two extremes in the Irish character in a very general sense. Things like suicide and, you know, one of the reasons why it's so difficult to measure the exact number of suicides is because so many suicides are people getting drunk and crashing their car. So, you know, not leaving a note behind. So there definitely has to be some connection with an excessive use of alcohol. And I do know by European standards, although we're with Britain in this, we have a much higher consumption of alcohol. Not only that, but, I mean, anyone who visits here from other parts of Europe notices, you know, just anecdotally on the streets, I mean, particularly young people, and you'll see this on St. Patrick's Day as well, I mean, there's a lot of drunkenness going on. and it does seem to have been increasing. So, yeah, who knows where that comes from? And that seems to go back into history. I mean, the cliches of Irish immigrants in the States, they were often portrayed as you know, heavy drinkers. This was part of the reason for anti-Irish prejudice. So,
well,
Say again?
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. You work with American students who are in Ireland studying, and you teach them about Ireland. When you meet them, when you interact with these students, when they're in your class for the first time, what would you say would be the biggest misconception they have about Ireland coming in?
Okay, that's a very good question, and it's something which I should have asked them. I think some of them have ended up... I think the strongest thing is that it's a much more ordinary place than they expect. And when they particularly talk to people their own age, they find an awful lot more in common in terms of popular culture, in terms of popular culture, pop cultural references, than they would expect. So in that regard, perhaps they feel they're on much more familiar terrain than they would have expected, which I've also heard tends to wear off after a few months. You know, the real cultural differences then begin to sort of become clearer. So maybe thinking it's more... the Western world is becoming so uniform anyway. But that would be the strongest one, that it's going to be more different from home than they expect.
Mm-hmm. All right, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to Wales, Wisconsin next, and we'll talk with Steve. Steve, good morning.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. First of all, I'll say it's just a grand show that you have here today. And I have a daughter who's living in Ireland for 6 months, and she's in. So this is a little bit of a lighter question.
Okay.
I've had some great ones so far, but this one might be a little lighter for you. But she's living in Dungarvan in the Waterford area. And
yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any insights about Dungarvan. It's a smaller village. Any historical insights or otherwise about it?
Okay, I've been to Dungarvan once before. I used to work for a company, a training company, which were based there. It's a very beautiful place, and that part of the country, I mean, that part of the southeast of Ireland is probably rather humorously referred to as the Irish Riviera, the sunny southeast, because although it rains a lot, I think it rains less there than anywhere else on the island. So to an outsider, it probably seems like it's terrible weather. The other thing that occurs to me, and you might find this a little bit surprising, is very close to Dungarvan, every summer there's a bluegrass festival. So I think it's the East or the West Tremore bluegrass festival, most of which is Irish people who play bluegrass music. And then, of course, visitors come from the United States as well. So I don't know if she's there in August. She might get a chance to listen to some bluegrass music a very, very long way from where the music came from. Although, of course, bluegrass music, I mean, there's a lot of cross-fertilization between traditional musics on these islands and the United States.
Well, I read an article the other day that credited the Scotch-Irish population in America for inventing country music, but we're ready to forgive them for that, I think.
Yeah, and country music, like all forms of music, if it's Johnny Cash, I mean, it's genius. If it's something else, maybe it's tacky and horrible. It very much depends on... The Scotch-Irish are a very interesting... area of Irish history, which has only really been very researched in recent years. And I know there's a Democrat, he used to be a Republican senator called Jim Webb from Virginia, who wrote a very interesting book about the Scotch-Irish, who they tended to emigrate to the United States before the massive emigration from Ireland after the famine in the 1840s. So, yeah, no, it's an interesting part of both Irish and United States heritage, the whole Scotch-Irish thing, apart from, you know, country music aside.
Well, and I was just kidding about that. I'll probably get some emails now, but you know, go ahead and send them. Let's see. We've got lots more callers here. I tell you what, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we'll have more calls, maybe some emails or a Facebook post or two. We're talking about Irish culture, the Irish economy, Irish politics, Irish stuff as we approach St. Patrick's Day, which, of course, is on Saturday. My guest is Donal. That's D-O-N-A-L. No D on the end, so don't call him Donal.
Yeah, it's Donal. It's a long O.
Donal.
Like, go, Donal.
Donal. Okay, yeah. All right. See, I should have asked that first. Anyway, he's an Irish illustrator and cartoonist, and he's also a lecturer at the Dublin Business School. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around. Next hour, my guest after 10 discusses how Greek and Roman mythology continues to influence Western culture to this day. That's next hour. This hour, it's about Ireland. And my guest, Donal Casey, an Irish illustrator and cartoonist, whose political cartoons appear in many publications in Ireland. He's also a lecturer at Dublin Business School. Full phone lines this morning. This is great. We'll go next to Elon from North Carolina. Good morning.
Hi, my name's Elise, and I was one of Donald's students last year, last spring. Well, I was one of the Americans, and we went to DBS, and you taught our winter term course, and you took us to the west of Ireland. And
yes, I remember.
We loved that experience, and it's really nice to hear you talking about Ireland right now. A lot of us are actually listening, and we feel very smart that we know about the Celtic Tiger and about the economic crisis. And
great.
We just loved our semester with you, and we really wanted to thank you for everything you taught us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. And we hope you have a great Paddy's Day in Ireland. We really wish.
Likewise, and say hello to everyone there. You can hear this program in North Carolina, can you?
Yeah, we can stream it online. Yep.
Okay, great, great.
Yeah, it's that whole internet thing. Who knew?
Yeah, that internet thing that we got here last year.
Yeah, there you go. All right, thank you, Elise, for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Rick in Monona. Rick, good morning.
Hello, good morning, Donal.
Good morning.
I'm glad to talk to you and hear about Ireland. There's so many questions I have, but the one I want to talk about is the Catholic Church in Ireland.
Yeah.
I know lately you've had your share of scandals connected to the Catholic Church. You had, they were the homes for unwed mothers that unveiled a lot of the awful things that were going on there, and then, of course, the sex scandals with some of your priests. And I know the Catholic Church has been a strong force in Ireland for years. I know you didn't have divorce for a long time. I'm just wondering how all that's changing.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I mean, the Catholic Church was at the very center of Irish life, and also, particularly in the period before independence, I mean, the Catholic Church was at the very center of much of Irish national identity. So Irish nationalism and Catholicism very, very often tended to go hand in hand. After independence, it left the Catholic Church with an enormous amount of power. And I suppose whatever the institution, whether it's a church or a political party, too much power is going to lead to abuses. There was a lot of child abuse, people often mention, well, it wasn't just the Catholic Church that was abusing children, but there was also a lot of institutional attempts to cover up for child abuse, which led to more child abuse happening, and so on and so forth. A lot of this began coming out very, very quickly in the 1990s, and there was a very sudden backlash against the church, the Catholic Church. I mean, I can remember in the 70s and 80s growing up in my hometown at Lone. I mean, you had over 90% of people going to Mass every Sunday. It was extraordinary. And everybody, I remember even as a teenager wondering, I mean, are all of these people really this religious? It was like a form of public conformism. Almost as very, very quickly, there was a change. I mean, the number of people attending Mass every Sunday has dropped from, I don't know, 90%. There are no official figures, but down to about a third in 10 years, which in countries like France and Spain took over 100 years to happen. Priests in the 1990s, I heard stories that priests in the 1990s began to stop dressing as priests in public because they were being spat at. And certainly that's an ongoing, I mean, the most tangible evidence for this, I suppose, is last year the Irish embassy in the Vatican was closed down. The argument being a number of other embassies were closed down as well in small countries. The idea being, well, it was part of the cutbacks, and we were talking about the economy earlier. But, you know, that could also be a manifestation of the fact that the state, the Irish state, were able to do this without an enormous amount of protest in Ireland was interesting. So, yeah, I mean, we've gone from one extreme to the other in that regard. I mean, and as you say, the Catholic Church, the laws, divorce only became legal here in 1997. You know, there were huge restrictions on contraception for a very long time. A very, very thorny issue here, and I know it's a very thorny issue in many parts of the world, is abortion. So you can't have a legal abortion in Ireland, although there's a bit of a legal vacuum in that regard. But Irish solution to an Irish problem, thousands and thousands of Irish women just go over to England and have abortions there. So, yeah, it's a very much in a state of dramatic transition at the moment as regards the relationship between the Catholic Church and Irish society.
Rick, thanks for the
an idea.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Let's go to Thank Christian you. In Milwaukee next. Good morning.
Hello, it's lovely to talk to you.
Hello.
First of all, I'd like to invite you to apparently it's the largest Irish festival outside of Ireland in Milwaukee. We have something called Irish Fest, and I've actually heard of it.
I must go. All I know about Milwaukee is I've seen Bridesmaids, so I know I know everything about Milwaukee. the extent of my knowledge of Milwaukee, but I've actually heard about that Irish Fest, and I know people who've been. So,
yeah.
When is it on? In the summer sometime.
And in fact, Basil McRae was here in Milwaukee, hosted by us on Monday, and we talked Northern Ireland politics and actually the impact of Irish Fest on his sort of political shift toward, you know, centrism, which was really
interesting.
And it actually ties to Ulster Scots. My question is, found out I have a Scotch Irish heritage in the north near Downpatrick, where another friend of mine, Dr. Tim Campbell, is with the St. Patrick Center. And my question is tied to the Scottish independence question and whether or not would the Ulster Scots in the north then identify possibly with Scotland rather than England? Would they maybe want a unified Northern Irish Scottish connection?
Yeah, that's a question I'd like to ask myself. Somebody that you'd need to ask somebody, an Ulster Scots person or a unionist. I mean, I do know that in what might be seen from the outside as the wilder reaches of political unionism in Northern Ireland, there is talk of independence for Northern Ireland. And you'll hear the term "this wee country," "we" being W-E-E, a Northern Irish sort of word for small. But I actually have to say I don't know the exact relationship between Ulster Unionists and Scotland. I would imagine they're pretty uncomfortable with it. That would be my feeling, because Ulster Unionists are so pro-union, whereas Scottish Nationalists, of course, aren't. So there's a bit of a contradiction there, even though, of course, as you've identified, I mean, a very large proportion of Ulster Unionists, their ancestors, came from Scotland.
And Christian, thank you for that. Irish Fest is in the summer. I don't have the exact dates, but we'll get them. And, you might want to come over and sample some of Milwaukee's beer. Let's see. Let's go to Watertown next and hear from Nicholas. Nicholas, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the interesting and candid guest. And I'm a retired forensic expert, and I work with law enforcement. I suspect what has happened in Ireland with the pub industry, liquor industry, organized crime is so strong in the industry that they influence the public officials. The public officials could limit drinking in Ireland, but they don't want to. The same in Wisconsin here. The Wisconsin Tavern Keepers Association is so powerful. It has influence over our political life. And Wisconsin is number one or number two for heavy beer drinking. So thank you. And I'll listen on the radio. Thank you again for your fine guests.
Okay. I'll mention alcohol in terms of the debate about limiting alcohol sales. I mean, currently, for example, there's a debate about prohibiting low-cost alcohol, and which is particularly aimed at students. And the flip side of that, then, is that an awful lot of events, sporting events, music events in Ireland depend hugely on drinks and alcohol, on drinks companies for their money. So there is that constant dilemma. I'm not sure how much organized crime is involved in the drink industry here or pubs. I mean, we have plenty of organized crime to do with drugs and other things. But yeah, I mean, there's a constant debate in Ireland about what to do about the what seems to be the excessive amount of drinking going on.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to McHenry, Illinois, and hear from Jim. Jim, good morning.
Good morning there. Hey, top of the morning to you, Lottie.
Maybe you say
mate, I don't know.
No, mate is English. No, although people in Dublin, some parts of Dublin, they might say mate as well.
Ah, good. Yeah, I'm a quarter Irish and I'm half Bohemian, and I enjoy doing all kinds of stuff. But I heard the comments earlier about the stereotypical Irish guys and all that stuff. It reminded me of what I always tell people about that, how many Irishmen does it take to change a light bulb, and it takes 100. It takes one to hold the light bulb and 99 to drink till the room spins. But
I wrote that joke.
You know that joke? Ah, you wrote that one. Ah, that's cool.
I saw somebody wearing a T-shirt yesterday. Which was, I'm fed up with these Irish stereotypes. When I finish this drink, I'm going to punch someone.
I like that. That's very good. I have to remember that. I have to keep that in my
mind. Yeah.
So, Jim, what was your question?
The question I had was, I've traveled around the country a lot in the United States. I've hitchhiked extensively all over the place. And I've hitchhiked in Europe not that much. And they don't like Americans that much now anymore in Spain and Italy. But in Ireland and UK, I think it's better as far as, like you said, I heard earlier, said, you know, everybody gets along over there pretty good. They like Americans. So I'm just wondering, if I were to go over there, like if I want to ride a bike around, if I want to hitchhike around, is that permissible? Is it people spit on you like they were, like you're talking about the priests and stuff, or how?
Okay, no, they certainly... And the thing about the priest being spat on, I'm sure that it happened. It probably happened once and became a huge story. But first of all, to answer your question, I mean, I think, and this is not directly from me, but from other people, it is a genuinely friendly place for people coming from all over the world. Cycling is great. I mean, the roads are pretty, you have to be quite careful, but cycling is becoming increasingly popular. I live in Dublin. I live very close to the city centre, and I cycle everywhere. I do have the excitement of knowing that I may not survive the day. It's not entirely safe, but certainly cycling is becoming increasingly common here. Hitchhiking is nowhere near as common as it used to be, I think, for the reasons that hitchhiking has become, you know, less common in many parts of the world. When I was a student 20 years ago, I used to hitchhike home every couple of weekends. I don't think you really see hitchhikers anywhere unless they actually know the person they're getting the lift from. But to answer your question, no, I mean, it's a very friendly place for Americans to come and visit.
And a very interesting place. Because there's certain spots here in the country that I wouldn't hitch a ride, and, you know, but I think I've gone to truck stops. And if you talk to people directly, a lot of people are really friends, say, yeah, come on. If you stand out on the road, it's kind of different. But I like small towns and the different areas like that, rural stuff like that. So your opinion would be maybe it'd be probably okay, huh?
Yeah, well, once you're speaking to the person, exactly, yeah.
All right, Jim. Thanks. Thanks for that. For the call. I intend when I retire, whenever that is, my intent is to make a European excursion, and I want to very much would like to visit Ireland. And I actually know I met a fellow from Northern Ireland who's a musician over here in the United States, and I told him, I said, I'd like to go. I'd like to visit Ireland, and he said. And he asked me why, and I said, well, I'd really like to develop an Irish brogue. And he said, oh, you said you'd never do it. And I said, oh, I think I've already got a start.
Yeah, you've actually done a pretty good imitation of a Northern Irish accent, surprisingly well, actually. That is quite good.
Well, if you hang out with enough Ulstermen, I guess you probably would.
Yeah, because it is a very different accent. I'm always astonished that people even refer to an Irish accent because we have so many different accents here.
Well, it's the same thing with American, I would imagine, because there are many dialects spoken here, some of them recognizable.
Exactly.
So I've done my bad Irish impression for the morning.
It was good. I'm not just saying that to be nice or because you had me on the program. No, it was actually quite good. So
okay,
if it had been bad, I would have sort of said nothing. It would have just been
well, good.
Or I would have changed the subject and sort of talked.
Well, I thought perhaps picking up an Irish brogue would be less ambitious than trying to speak Glaswegian if I went to Scotland.
I imagine so.
Okay. I wanted to make sure that I asked this. What haven't we talked about that you think would be really important as we close the show here? We've got a couple of minutes left. What haven't we touched on?
Yeah. So we've talked about the politics. We talked about the godforsaken recession. The religion question did come up. The man about Northern Ireland is asking why I use that term. But I honestly can't think offhand. I mean, does any area occur to you as we talked about the media?
Well, what about Irish media? What's television like in Ireland?
Okay, now the other thing is, I mean, Irish media, again, like when I was talking to Phil Hand about the, or Phil Hands, I can't remember, is it plural or singular? The cartoonist from the Wisconsin State Journal, but there's Irish media and then there's a lot of British media. So television, for example, a lot of people watch British TV. They watch Sky TV. They watch the BBC. We also have Irish channels, and that's another area which is being debated at the moment because it's essentially public television, and they're receiving money but they also have advertising. But a lot of people say, well, I never watch Irish television. I only watch British television. Why should I pay what we have here, which is a television license? You have to pay not an enormous amount of money, but you pay that money every year if you have a television. The main television station is called RTE, Radio Telefigeren, which is the Irish language bit. Maybe language would be an interesting one. You asked, are there any questions? The whole language question, we talked about accent, but there is the other language in Ireland, Irish. There's the Ulster Scots dialect stroke language in Northern Ireland as well, if anyone had a question about that.
Well, you know what? I think we should have you back and cover all the stuff we didn't get to, and I'm sure we'd end up with a lot more callers, but we're out of time. So, Donal Casey, thank you for being my guest this morning.
Thank you very much.
Donal Casey is an Irish illustrator and cartoonist and a lecturer at the Dublin Business School. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Cynthia Schuster handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.